John Batchelor. This is the John Batchelor Show. Good evening. D-Day, 1944, June 6th. It is now 69 years later, June 7th, and the battle is engaged and not determined in any fashion. There was no success to report, not on the 6th, not on the 7th, not on the 8th. The beachhead was very fragile. Eisenhower back at the Supreme Quarters, Headquarters Allied Expeditionary Force was no longer entertaining pulling the troops off Omaha as he was in the first hours. However, the anxiety was about what would the Germans do, when will they counterattack, when will they move their SS Panzer Division in, and why was Montgomery having such difficulty on the left? In any event, that's the tactics and the sacrifice going on right now. I welcome my colleague Michael Vlahos, Professor Michael Vlahos from the Naval War College, the views here is his own, because we're reflecting not on the immediate events of the 6th, 7th, and all that summer until the liberation of Paris, the vast battle of Normandy that spread out over those 3 months, 750,000 casualties on both sides, and the largest land battle ever fought, to my knowledge, in the 20th century or since then, a continuous battle. We're reflecting on what it means 69 years later. Michael, a very good evening to you.
Good evening, John.
Michael, the D-Day, we've spoken when I was in Normandy a year ago, and we're speaking now on the anniversary, and again, because you have very carefully developed these last years, the idea that D-Day was America's entry into the world. This is the American Empire beginning. But we had a mission that day. What is it, Michael? What can we say about that mission now, 69 years later?
It's almost hard to speak in terms that look toward higher levels of opportunity. But I do believe that there was an element of strategy underway here that we subconsciously configured for ourselves. That is, namely, to configure the most difficult piece of the occasion, of the experience, to be Omaha Beach. In other words, we deprived the British Empire, the Canadians and the British, of their opportunity for heroic sacrifice, of which they'd had more than enough in the earlier war, in World War I, and they weren't really up for that anyway. But we made sure that the great sacrifice was going to be ours that day. And the great sacrifice was what was required. And so in order for this battle to create and set up and tee off everything that was to happen up until our own time, as the remote posterity of 1944, we had to create not just a mythic moment, but a moment of unique American sacrifice. And I think we not only managed to do that, we managed to shape that as an experience that then performs for us constantly, even as we speak, even as we look back. It is, in some ways, the great liturgy of the American experience, not just in World War II, but of the America that was born on that day. And it's kind of a high mass of the nation and of the American ethos.
The Redeemer Nation. Let's listen to General Eisenhower, Supreme Commander, Allied Expeditionary Force. This is the message to the soldiers, sailors, and airmen, but it's repeated all during that day. It's played in CBS radio back home. General Eisenhower, who would go on, of course, to become President of the United States, is speaking directly to those engaged in the battle. But there's a language here about sacrifice and about the expectation that when America is successful, it will have earned itself once again the city on a hill, everybody looking to it to redeem the world. Here is General Eisenhower.
Soldiers, sailors, and airmen of the Allied Expeditionary Force, you are about to embark upon the great crusade toward which we have striven these many months. The eyes of the world are upon you. The hopes and prayers of liberty-loving people everywhere march with you. In company with our brave allies and brothers in arms on other fronts, you will bring about the destruction of the German war machine, the elimination of Nazi tyranny over the oppressed peoples of Europe, and security for ourselves in a free world. Your task will not be an easy one. Your enemy is well-trained, well-equipped, and battle-hardened. He will fight savagely. But this is the year 1944. Much has happened since the Nazi triumphs of 1940-41. The United Nations have inflicted upon the Germans great defeats in open battle, man to man. Our air offensive has seriously reduced their strength in the air and their capacity to wage war on the ground. Our home fronts have given us an overwhelming superiority in weapons and munitions of war and placed at our disposal great reserves of trained fighting men. The tide has turned. The free men of the world are marching together to victory. I have full confidence in your courage, devotion to duty, and skill in battle. We will accept nothing less than full victory. Good luck, and let us all beseech the blessing of Almighty God upon this great and noble undertaking.
Dwight David Eisenhower, June 6, 1944, to the battle and to the world. And Michael, I'm just struck by the black and white of the universe that the general proposes. We're going to free the world and overcome evil. It is 69 years later, and the mission is still there. Does the world listen to us, Michael, for the sacrifice we made and the battle we enjoined?
Well, the world cannot discount or forget what happened. And if you listen to the speech, as we just did, you see how carefully Eisenhower sets up all of the tropes behind this, the majestic endeavor. I mean, he clearly leads off with the word crusade,
mm-hmm.
Which has many associations in our own history and you know, long ago provenance. But he goes on to describe a world of peoples expectantly waiting for us, and you can see this in all of the mythology created during and after D-Day of the French resistance and of these people in Europe oppressed by the Nazis longing to be liberated, of the whole idea of the world being with us, and then shifting into a presentation of the great power that has sort of coiled up inside of the U.S. And that itself is the testament that God is with us. And so what Eisenhower is doing is laying out the entire argument that we are the agent of the Lord himself. And that is a tremendously powerful thing. And to imagine being a soldier heading toward those beaches with those words in your head, believing that you are it, that without you, you know, the world will fall. But with you, you know, the world can be redeemed. People ask, you know, how we succeeded on that day, but it's quite clear that these emotions were coursing through ordinary American men, very young men, and helps to explain the triumph of that day. And the sacrifice is the proof, the sort of, after the Civil War, the Republicans, as you recall, went to victory in election after election, and it was famously said that they waved the bloody shirt.
Right.
Well, that bloody shirt was what cemented American leadership in the world for the next 70 years, and I don't know that it is it has any of that authority anymore. This is the great concern nearly 70 years after D-Day, is that bloody shirt has been waved one too many times.
This is the year 1944, says General Eisenhower. When we come back, this is the year 2013. D-Day today in the world, in the 21st century. I'm John Batchelor. This is the John Batchelor Show. This is the John Batchelor Show. Professor Michael Vlahos of the Naval War College and I are reflecting 69 years after June 6, 1944, in the battle, we've listened to General Eisenhower's words about the Great Crusade. This is the year 1944, says the general, is just to sweep away all the doubts that the evil, the Nazi Empire, the tyranny of Europe, has anything any longer to stop us. But 69 years later, we've secured Europe, we've defeated the Cold War. The enemy, not quite acknowledged by General Eisenhower that day, would be the Red Tyrants closing on the German tyrants from the east. And we're here in the 21st century, another crusade. We set that aside, Michael, but does the world quickly forget? Is that necessary? Is that, in fact, natural, that the world would forget the sacrifice the U.S. put out and that we have to start from zero, just as everyone else does, Michael?
No empire that I can recall has ever been so successful in internationally, you know, among a community of nations and peoples, waved a bloody shirt so successfully for so long as did the United States of America after 1945. So, I mean, we've played that out, and we played it well. But the Cold War is long gone. And our naked, invisible attempt to recreate that after 9/11, 2001, has failed. And it has failed because we did not come through as the Americans who landed at D-Day came through for the world. And this is, for me at least, personally, the occasion of great sadness. But the fact is that it is all done. I mean, we did what we did after 2001, and it's now played out. And I think it's essential for the United States either to find some way to honestly and authentically rekindle and reawaken that belief, honesty, and trust among others, or to let it go. And I'm not sure that we can do either. We're still pretending somehow, like those enfeebled Republicans in the 1880s, say in the Benjamin Harrison administration, still trying to keep it going, and it has no strength or power anymore. Whether we're talking Republicans or Democrats, whether we're talking, you know, Samantha Power, whether we're talking Bill Kristol, that vision of automatic American leadership because we're Americans, and somehow long ago in the distant, you know, misty mountains of memory, we somehow led the world to redemption, is not going to work any longer.
A puzzle, Michael. You mentioned Samantha Power. She was one of the authors of the Responsibility to Protect that was applied to Libya. She's now the ambassador to the United Nations, along with her colleague Susan Rice, who takes national security advisor. The Obama administration, they're of two minds. I can't tell now whether we're a besieged nation, Fortress America, or whether we're an engaged America projecting democracy into the Maghreb, for example, or into the Mashriq, into Syria. Is that ambiguity a problem for us?
And why are you confused, John? You're confused because all of this rhetoric being ladled out is directed almost totally on the American domestic audience. All of the, you know, ancient and crusty language is being directed only at a domestic political audience for rather venal ends. I don't see any clarion call on the part of American leaders to the rest of humanity for the sake of humanity. None of that exists, and it is that lack of authenticity that is the basis for mistrust and loss of American world authority. And it is the inability, in fact, maybe even the denial of people in the Washington world, in the imperial court. It is the obdurate venality of the courtiers of the Washington scene that have led us to the place that we now inhabit.
Do we need an enemy, Michael? Is that going to satisfy? You know, the Japanese came along and provided for the Second World War, and the Chinese now are of a mixed mind, but they're certainly colonial masters. They're exploiting their opportunities in Africa and in the Middle East, and they're building a fleet. Is that going to reawaken America's a redeemer nation?
Well, the fact that we we speak in terms of an enemy as the essence of the issue also amplifies and highlights what has been lost. Because in the 1930s and 40s, it wasn't the enemy so much as the threat to humanity. And obviously, the threat to humanity was an enemy. But it wasn't necessarily first about the enemy. It was first about humanity and the parlous state into which humanity had fallen. That should be the object of our focus as a nation today, is the future of humanity, which itself is under threat. But the threat today is multivalent and not so easily shaped into something like a cardboard mask, as it was in the 1940s. Humanity is a need, though, and we're not stepping up to that need. Instead, we're saying, oh, where's the threat? But we're here's the deal. We're thinking in World War II terms by trying to constantly replay that narrative that worked so successfully to us, rather than understanding what the source of the narrative was, and understanding that the essence of what we were able to offer to the world and the essence of what we became, our very identity, was based on that source, not the expressions of that source.
We have an organization that can spy just as good as the Chinese can. In fact, we're better than anybody in the 21st century, in the 20th century. Is that part of the difficulty now, Michael, that we've become not just the Fortress America, but an empire that can abuse its powers as well? Just we have no way of actually proving that we're the city on the hill. We could easily be the castle on the hill, and you're this is a feudal world.
This is a tremendous disconnect that you identify, John, in the sense that we're still using publicly and to ourselves this language from another age, and that language is disconnected from the reality of how we operate and the venality that is the basis for our behavior. So we are acting in ways that are not worthy, and yet we're still using the language that once invoked made us the leader of the world. And so not only is this mismatch a kind of corruption, but we are literally day by day debasing that language so that it can no longer be used. And I think this is a tremendously dangerous way to behave. If we want to be the country we once were, then let us do it. But let us enjoin sincerely all of the things we once stood for. And let us not go about pretending that selfish needs and rather unworthy actions on our part daily can somehow be conflated,
Michael Vlahos,
with great language and our great past.
Michael Vlahos, the Naval War College. The Great Crusade is over. I'm John Batchelor. This is The John Batchelor Show. I'm John Batchelor. This is The John Batchelor Show. Fanny and Freddy, not just happy little puppies that you can feed and play with, also great big stories of the Great Recession of 2007-2008. Fanny and Freddy into what was then called conservatorship, which was a puzzling status in the summer of 2008. That was a strong sign that we were headed down the whole economy. But now, these many years later, I learned from Clea Benson, who writes on housing policy at Bloomberg, that Fannie and Freddie are back. They have new leadership, in fact, making money. There's talk of more and more dividends being paid out. At the same time, full stop. The United States Senate and other members of the legislature are looking to shut down, make go away, end Fannie and Freddie, and what is to become of the American housing market. Clea, this is a puzzle. Just when the new leadership at Fannie is boasting of a big profit margin, I think the way it was put on Bloomberg TV, bigger than Walmart, there's talk of shutting them down. Is this a paradox? Are these two worlds not talking to each other? Good evening to you.
Good evening. Well, it's an interesting story. And, you know, one issue here is that Fannie and Freddie have taken about $187, $188 billion from the United States taxpayers while they've been in conservatorship. And even though they started posting record profits all of a sudden last year, they still haven't given back to the U.S. government as much as they have taken. And so, meanwhile, in Washington, they are widely viewed as a problem. They're viewed as part of the reason for the financial crisis in the first place. And so there's still a view that even though if you let them hang around for long enough, taxpayers will make back all of their money and more, that they should be wound down because we don't want the same thing to happen again. So there's a feeling that instead you should replace them with something that, you know, helps the government provide liquidity to the mortgage market, but doesn't put the government in a first loss position like they were this time.
I watched the presentation by Bloomberg News. Tim Mayopoulos is the Fannie Mae CEO, and he spoke of two different parts of the Fannie Mae operation. There is the new book of mortgages, and then there's the legacy book. I take it from your remarks that the legacy book is the problem. That's where all the losers are. That's where the money hasn't been repaid back, and not likely in our lifetime. Is that's the equivalent of a bad bank. Do the senators want to make the legacy book go away and keep the new book, or do they just want to shut the whole thing down and rename it?
Well, so in the there's this bipartisan, as you mentioned, there's this bipartisan effort in the Senate to come up with a plan for overhauling housing finance policy overall. And what they would do under that plan is they would transfer all of the existing obligations of Fannie and Freddie over to the U.S. Treasury, and then they would liquidate any assets that Fannie and Freddie have because, you know, in addition to guaranteeing mortgage securities, they also have some assets on their books that they had invested in, and a lot of those are bad assets.
That would be part of the legacy book. All the bad stuff is legacy.
Correct.
Book. It used to be called a bad bank. Now we just call it legacy.
Right. And then what they would do is they would replace them with a government agency that would insure mortgage securities, but only after a private capital had taken a significant amount of the upfront risk. So it would prevent the government from being on the hook in the event, you know, during the next housing downturn. Fannie and Freddie, you know, currently back half of all of the outstanding mortgages in America.
Right.
And so, the obligation of Fannie and Freddie to pay out in case those mortgages go bad, that obligation would get transferred over to the Treasury, as well as the fees that Fannie and Freddie collect for those guarantees. So Treasury would be, getting the revenue as well as the obligation. But, of course, you know, if the housing market is doing better, it's not necessarily going to, you know, how that book performs, might not be so bad.
This is a puzzle, Clea, because I think you just told me that the Treasury is going to turn into a for-profit organization. It's going to administer it as if it has a bottom line. Is it going to have customers? Are you going to call up the Treasury and say, let's make a deal on my mortgage?
Well, those are very interesting questions, right? But, I mean, basically they have to let the existing obligations run off, the existing book run off. So they wouldn't just cut off people who currently have mortgages backed by Fannie and Freddie.
Right.
Somebody has to administer them.
What about the profits? I mean, $17 billion, more than Walmart's. That's a lot of money pouring into Treasury. Is Treasury ready to be a money-making organization?
Well, Treasury now is getting the money. So the arrangement under the conservatorships is that all profit from Fannie and Freddie goes straight into Treasury. They have to provide it. And it's an interesting construct, because it doesn't really count as a payback of the debt that Fannie and Freddie owe to taxpayers. It's basically considered to be a dividend on the government's investment in them. And so there's actually technically no way for them to pay back their debt and say, okay, we're ready to become independent again. It's sort of like a permanent indentured sort of state that they're in. Now, there's a lot of investors in Fannie and Freddie who think that that system should be changed.
Yes,
they
want to change the system, but there are investors now buying on the eventuality that Fannie will be liquidated. This is the big hedge funds, Paulson & Company, Claren Road Asset Management. Why are they buying it? What do they think there's profit in it?
They do, because they think, and those firms have actually been down in Washington lobbying. What they want is different from what's been put out in the Senate bill. What they want is a mechanism by which Fannie and Freddie can repay their debt to the taxpayers and then be spun off again as independent entities. So they want, in that case, the bet is that your junior preferred shares will then have some value in this new company. Senior preferred shares are the shares that are owned by the U.S. government. That's sort of the form that the government bailout took, is they, quote unquote, bought senior preferred shares in the company.
So I should regard the Secretary of the Treasury, Mr. Liu, as the boss of the senior preferred shares right now.
That's correct, yes.
Right. So the junior preferred shares are arguing with the senior preferred shares. What about the common shares, the stuff that people can buy?
Well, I think that that's why a lot of folks are now bidding up the price of the common shares as well, because they're thinking that possibly Congress will choose to, liberate Fannie and Freddie from the government at some point. But it's a very risky bet, because the mindset down here in Washington is that these companies, helped cause the crisis, and they should be dismantled. So it's not likely. Bob Corker, the senator from Tennessee, who's writing this legislation, says it's a very risky lottery ticket, is what he says about it.
Clea, is there a timeline that they have for this? This Congress, next Congress, can this negotiation last through the rest of the administration?
It certainly can. The Senate says that they want to introduce something as soon as this month, but in reality, it'll take a long time for any consensus to build, especially with all of these different interests sort of weighing in. And if they get anything even moving before the end of the year, it'll be surprising. So it may well go into next year, and it may well go into the next presidential administration. So nobody should hold their breath. But what's happening now is sort of a movement forward on what exactly the overall structure will be for housing finance. It's the very beginnings.
Clea Benson for Bloomberg News, housing policy. Fannie and Freddie, not dead yet, making money. I'm John Batchelor. This is The John Batchelor Show.
Be John Batchelor's Facebook friend? Just log on to facebook.com/Batchelor Show.
Surrender all my love to you. wrote a sweet romance. I know all my whole life through I'll be remembering you whatever else I do. Midnight were the stars and you.
The Great Gatsby, the novel is published in 1925, and literary criticism will tell you it didn't do much. It did not live up to the expectations of F. Scott Fitzgerald. Its reason at the time was that it was about the flapper era, there were ironies in it, and it didn't catch hold of the young audience. Fitzgerald himself said, "You know, the readers of my books tend to be strong females, and I didn't give them a character to like. I didn't give them a female character." He thought that the rest of his life, and at his death, he thought that he'd been a failure as a novelist and that The Great Gatsby had great promise, but he hadn't followed up on it. Here we are in the 21st century, and Brooks Barnes, reporting for The New York Times, about Great Gatsby, the latest iteration, a movie that opened, I believe, in 3D, but with some big stars and apparently Hollywood's doubts. Brooks, a very good evening to you. Is it too much to say that Hollywood doubted another version of The Great Gatsby? Good evening.
No, not at all. They're more than doubted. They flat out said, "You're nuts to do it," and we're not going to be one of them.
They're not, you're nuts to do it. In other words, these stars, I mean, Leonardo DiCaprio and is a huge star. Baz Luhrmann, I didn't know anything about him, but he's a serious director. And they threw themselves in. They spent a lot of money. What's not to like?
So, well, you hit on the exact nail of it, which is the money. So, you know, studios are looking around, and they're always trying to measure their risk, right? So they're looking at this. On the one hand, you've got Leonardo DiCaprio, big movie star. He was attached early on. And you've got this literary material that is known worldwide. Great. And Baz Luhrmann has a history of making movies that attract young audiences, Moulin Rouge and Romeo and Juliet. And then on the other hand, they start looking down the line. They put their finger down the chart and see, oh, he wants to make it for that much money. Dramas, then here come the doubts. Dramas don't really succeed that well, especially now. And then you have other problems with the literary history. There's always a movie you can point to that didn't work,
right,
that can talk yourself out of it. So and then another movie actually did not work. Sony, it was set up to make Great Gatsby, this version, and had a big flop in this movie, How Do You Know, with Reese Witherspoon, and then got cold feet. So after that, pretty much every studio in town at some level said, too risky. And then Warner finally gave it another look and said, okay, we're in.
Now the surprise. It's doing very well. If I understand these numbers, $330 million sounds like a good number. Is it? I've lost count, Brooks. Is that a good number these days?
That is a good number, especially for a drama, right? If that's what this is, a period drama. But always with Hollywood, there's the perception and the reality. And the problem with this is that we don't really know the reality, because on the surface, it's absolutely a hit in the perception category. $330 million could actually even be $350 million, depending on how some overseas markets do. It hasn't opened in Japan yet. That's a lot of money. And then you've got all of the DVD and television sales of the next 3 to 5 years that they call ancillary funds, and that could generate $200 million. The problem is that then you start divvying all that up, and how much does the studio get? Leonardo DiCaprio gets a cut. We don't know how much. Baz Luhrmann gets a cut. We don't know how much. The theater owners take theirs. How much was the marketing? And so that's when you start getting down into it. You have to wonder, it's definitely a success, but how much money they're making, no one knows.
When I saw you do this story, Brooks, was eager to speak to you about it because I was doing research recently about the landing in Omaha and Utah and Gold and Juneau and Sword beaches, 1944. And I learned, and I saw photographs, that at that time, 1942-44, they distributed paperbacks to the soldiers overseas to read while they're sitting in their foxholes waiting for the next attack. And Great Gatsby was one of the most successful novels read during the Second War. And when I saw your story, I thought, never bet against Gatsby. I mean, never. It's like it's a winner no matter what you think. But I do suggest to myself there's a possibility here. Is it because Robert Redford's still alive? Is that the problem? Because he made the definitive 20th century version and they didn't want to compete with it?
I think that you're giving Mr. Redford too much credit for the shadow he cast in Hollywood. No. But I do think that you're right, that look at the source material. It's you don't bet against this guy. You never quite know what he's made of himself. Is kind of amazing, right? In the plot line,
right? Gatsby himself reinvents himself. So this movie is for those of us who dream. You know, can I be a different person? Can I make it up?
And it's taught in every high school, pretty much every high school, still today. I know this because my mother teaches English, 11th grade, and all of her students were excited to see it.
Right.
And when you have a movie about a book, especially an old book, that kids are interested to check out, that's pretty much the best you can get.
Right. In 1942-44, who's reading it? 19-, 20-, 22-year-olds in foxholes. They come back. They have the generation called the boomers. That's me, right? We have children. We keep passing it on. It's like a rite of passage. Now, back to Hollywood. They made it in 3D. Did that matter?
It mattered in one important way, which is how much it cost.
Uh-huh.
That added, a lot, millions and millions of dollars to the production budget, and then you've got to supply all the studio pays for all of those glasses that we wear.
Did they think they needed to do it because they wanted an edge, and did they overthink this? Could they have done it without it?
That was part, as I understand it, was part of Baz Luhrmann's vision that he really wanted to. Is part of a freshening, looking at this through new eyes. Use that, and that 3D isn't something that traditionally a drama certainly has not been presented that way. So that was a little bit of his artistic idea, all of it. And it turned out that it added box office, right? So those screenings cost $3 to $5 roughly if you're going to a premium IMAX. A version, a premium price on a ticket,
right?
But not very many people went to see it in 3D.
What about in iTunes, which is the only way I can ever see a movie? Can I see a 3D in iTunes? Can they do that yet, or is it going to be turned into a 2D or whatever you call it?
It's a 2D.
It's a 2D.
At the moment, I'm pretty sure, but I think that's coming. You have to buy a 3D TV.
3D TV. I see. So I can. I'm always eager to spend money on Hollywood. You understand this, Brooks? Now, can we back to DiCaprio? He looks to have been a magnificent Gatsby. Is he getting credit for this? I haven't seen the movie, but his whole career looks like Gatsby. He was ready for Gatsby.
Yeah, I mean, people really seem to have, fans for sure, have embraced that. What's interesting is the reviews. I didn't mention this in the article, but the reviews are pretty much split 50-50. And that was a surprise to a lot of people that, one, on a movie like this, the critics didn't seem to matter to a lot of people. They went to see it anyway. And that's not usually the case on a movie that's of a more serious variety.
And that was Carey Mulligan. I'll mention the star, but forever, it's Mia Farrow to me. I'm stuck. Okay. Brooks Barnes for the New York Times. The Great Gatsby, 3D, doing very well despite all odds. I'm John Batchelor. This is the John Batchelor Show. Good night.